This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Well, I'm so happy I have here in the studio with me, Tantalk Radio Network studio here in glorious Clearwater, Florida, I have Bill Larson of Larson & Larson. He is our legal eagle, and we have a lot of things to discuss. I have been getting over the Christmas holidays and into January. A lot of writers have been really getting busy, getting active, and things have been sort of going wild in a lot of different areas. So it's so nice to welcome you here, Bill.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I sent you a few things that are going on and some general subject that we really need to address, because writers out there have so many things to deal with. And, you know, in addition to having to be their own publicists, their own editors, this. Whoa, nowadays, you know, if you're not with a big publishing house.
They step out of bounds and they're their own worst enemy.
That's okay? Right.
And that's what happens with a lot of artists and other folks, authors, coming up through the ranks. A simple statement that can be misinterpreted could send you the wrong way and ruin your career. You have to be very careful. A lot of these folks, a lot of authors and artists, don't hire professional to monitor them and keep them on the straight and narrow about what they say and do and how they're seen in public. It only takes one screw up, and no one ever forgets it.
That's right.
They say it takes a lifetime to get a great reputation, and it takes one word to ruin it for life. So people need to be very careful. And the subject that we were going to talk about today is what seems to be a match lit in an association that we won't mention for reasons.
We don't want to get sued.
Yeah, we certainly don't want to stoke the fire. So we want to kind of talk about it in terms of what happened and what can happen and why you shouldn't do this and why it doesn't help, okay, in our current society right now. So why don't you tee it up in terms of kind of the factual situation.
Okay, it's really relatively simple. There are a lot of different writers' associations and a lot of different associations. And if you are in an association and you complain about somebody because you don't like what they've done, or if in the case of a writer, you don't like something that somebody has written, and you take it immediately to Twitter or Facebook, but you know, or Instagram, and you
publish it.
Mm-hmm. You write it there, and it's got your name on it. And
it's there forever.
It's there forever. And somebody did that with a major association, and it has now split the association apart, because some people take one side and some people take the other side, and now everybody is confused, and there are a lot of potential litigation and things.
So yes.
What the first that sort of instigated was one tweet. One
single tweet.
That's
how every giant
thousands
bomb explodes.
After that, thousands.
One
of,
match lights the fuse,
exactly.
And then the whole forest burns down. So you have to be very careful, because what I have seen over the years is that very simple statements, sometimes seemingly innocuous, just take off and create these just battles among people. And we got to remember that in a country like ours, where we have a lot of free speech and everybody does speak their mind, a lot of people have agendas, okay? We're a country that's trying to overcome racism, misogyny, anti-Semitism, all of these things, become a greater country, which they don't enjoy in other countries. And there's a price to pay for that, okay? Because when people start airing their grievances or announcing their agendas, you're going to rub somebody wrong, okay? And then that's going to backfire. And then it just grows from there, right? It's just a snowball going down the hill. So when you frame these kind of things, if you are going to publish something on the internet, and particularly something that's a hot button issue, okay? Like racism, like misogyny, like politics, like abortion, any of the hot button issues, you have to be extremely careful the way you word your comments and ask yourself, is this something that I want to write and publish on the internet, where it'll be seen forever, or maybe I just write this in the sand and the waves will blow it away and it'll be gone tomorrow. You really have to be careful about what you say in this day and age.
So in this case, it's an organization that, you know, no one, generally speaking, and this is absolutely true, I've discovered with writers, they are all helping each other, they're encouraging each other, and these organizations are good for that.
The
network, that's the whole purpose, they help each other. But when one person says something that just, as you said, lights a fuse, and then
everybody
thousand
starts
emails,
taking sides.
That's right. And now in this case, they're very likely going to break up simply because they've lost support in the industry. And, you know, in the publishing world, it's a very...
These things can be repaired. Yeah. There are actually companies that come in and repair these types of things. Okay,
Damage control companies.
They do it all the time. So it's not something that I would say is fatal. It should be something that should be put back together. But I think the greater lesson in everything here is for our authors is that you need to be very careful about what you publish, and particularly if you're talking about another person. Okay, because if what you say is taken the wrong way, that could be considered defamation and you're facing a lawsuit. I mean, worse than just getting kicked out of an association or, you know, you can actually face a lawsuit. I'm handling a case right now where we're going to be prosecuting somebody for a horrible defamation that absolutely destroyed another person's career. The person was upset at the time. Okay, we get it. Everybody gets upset. But you have to bite your lip and, you know, just take it sometimes. Because once it's out there and everybody reads it and there's any kind of adverse effect to that other person, defamation comes in and you're the subject of a very powerful lawsuit that can destroy you financially.
Now, in this case, it's more than saying, you know, I don't like this book. It's
right.
Saying accusing the person of in this case racism.
We have issues of First Amendment. Okay,
yeah.
Anybody can say anything they want. The First Amendment is not designed to protect speech that you like. It's designed to protect speech that you hate. Okay, that's all the First Amendment does. It allows people to say the most hateful, disgusting things that they want, and the government can't stop them. Okay, and that rubs up against what citizens can say. Okay. So if a citizen says something, it's not a violation of free speech as to the other person or to the company they work for, okay? Free speech only deals with the government. So where they wander into a problem with saying something that's mean or hurtful or wrong, incorrect, and obviously if it's incorrect, then you're in a lot of big trouble, that yes, you can say it, but the question is, should you say it? And if you're going to say it, how are you going to say it? Be very, very careful. So it's not a First Amendment violation, but it is a statutory violation, potentially, of defamation. And if it doesn't rise to the level of defamation, it could hurt somebody anyway or hurt that person's career because now you're going to be remembered as the complainer or the person that started the fire.
Yes, well, that's essentially what's happened.
That's what's happening.
Now, in the case of the person who was complained against, of course, she says that's not true, and she, you know, I don't know where the lawsuits are going to go now, because when people jumped in, some people said even worse things.
Yes.
I mean, really, to bear, you know, they like exactly what you said. What's your suggestion to people before they push send?
Yeah. Go in the mirror and look at yourself and ask yourself, am I ready for what's going to happen after I push the button? If the answer is yes, and you can take a, you know, big punch in the nose, and you really want to start a fight, then okay. But I think most of us would say, no, I really don't want to say this. You know, the humans are reactive animals. That's we react very quickly, and a lot of times we don't think before we react. That's what created lawyers. Okay, people that don't think before they react, and that's why I'm here. So after they react and they do something terrible, and then they injure somebody, then they come to me and say, "Oh Lord, save me! Please save me from myself." And I said, "Well, you know, the cow's out of the barn. You know, we're going to have to just deal with it now. It's a financial problem. So certainly understand in the very charged atmosphere that we have right now in our country politically, with respect to almost all issues, that it's better to just keep it to yourself. If you want to have a private conversation about something, I can understand that. But in terms of these associations and the Twitter and all of these public forums and blogs where you can post stuff, I wouldn't post anything that other than something that was very, very nice about the beautiful blue sky or the lovely steak I had for dinner. I tell a lot of people when I coach them, I say, when you go into a party or you go with people, I said, you know, keep it to sports, weather. I mean, there's like five topics that are just completely neutral, you know, that you can never get in trouble with. But the problem is that people are charged. There may be underlying agendas. There may be underlying fights or something going on that we don't know about. And then the things get published, and that's what really creates the legal problem for these folks.
Now, what happens with several things? Now, the woman who was originally criticized, if her sales go down, if she has problems with sales now, and she decides to sue the other person.
And you can link that to the statement.
So you can link that.
You have a remedy.
So now you have things that you have to keep records of, and from like the day that it happened to anything that's sort of built on it. But in this case, for example, the first woman started it, but then a lot of people jumped in and said even worse things. And now
they can all be collectively sued.
They could all be collectively sued.
And it's almost like a gang mentality, you know.
It is in many cases.
Everybody jumps in and starts throwing punches. And so we really need to learn how to temper ourselves, okay? We really need to learn and teach ourselves, you know, to think carefully about what we're going to say and when we're going to say it. Lawyers were obviously taught that way. They beat that into our heads in law school. That's why when you hear lawyers talk, you're like, he didn't say anything. Well, of course he didn't. He didn't want to get in trouble.
He doesn't want to say
it. Exactly. So lawyers speak, and politicians do the same thing, right? They talk in these generalities and stuff, and that's why they usually don't get in trouble. And the ones that talk very straight sometimes do. So you need to teach yourself and learn, if you're going to be part of associations or if you want to be a famous writer or artist or a musician or this, that, or the other, you've got to learn how to keep your dang mouth shut.
Good advice. That's great advice, because it really, in this case, it got carried away, and it would be a shame if something happened to the organization. But now there's a third level. People who might belong to this association are now afraid to tell agents, potential publishers, that they belong to the organization. What used to be a matter of pride. I mean, they would put it on their letters. They would put it on the bottom.
Collateral damages. Yeah.
But if you feel like, for example, and this I think has happened already. Someone who is a member of this organization was told essentially by an agent that, well, I really don't want anything to do with this group.
Agents are smart that way, because they want to see where it's all going to fall out.
Yeah.
You know, what's left, you know, after the fire goes out. Hopefully it can be put back together and everything will be okay. Everybody will come out and apologize and make their amends or make copas or whatever you got to do to fix it. But for the purposes of our conversation today, we just want to warn people and admonish people. Just be very careful what you say in public.
Exactly.
Better to say nothing.
And which brings us to another question, which I was asked over the past few months. I think because of the political situation in this country, I've been asked by a lot of my listeners, how can I remain anonymous? Nom de plume, you know, so many
pseudonymous,
people have.
Yeah. A lot of people write under a pen name or pseudonymous. And there's a lot of reasons for it. If you go back historically, remember that 150 years ago, 200 years ago, a woman was not allowed to write a book and get paid for it.
That's right.
Just the law didn't provide for it, right? So they had to adopt pseudonyms. But throughout history, people have used pseudonyms for a number of different reasons. Either they didn't have the sexy name that really went with the type of work they were doing, or that they wanted to write a subject that they didn't want to be linked to. So there's scores of reasons. Now, under copyright law, you're allowed to register your copyright as a pseudonym, so no one knows who you are. So you can get your registration, just put in your pseudonym, whatever that may be, and then usually what you do is assign the copyright into a holding company in Nevada or Delaware or Wyoming or somewhere that doesn't have any kind of disclosure of owners, and then no one can find out who you are. So I've gone back in history, and looked up some names, and let's see if our listeners can tell the pseudonym. Who's behind the pseudonym? Okay. Mark Twain.
Okay. Well, Samuel Clemens got that one.
Okay. Dr. Seuss?
I don't actually remember anymore.
Theodore Seuss Geisel.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Robert Galbraith.
Oh.
J.K. Rollins.
Oh, J.K. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cassandra Clare.
Who's that?
Judith Rumlet. Rummelt?
Rummelt? Yeah, okay.
Richard Bachman. Stephen King.
Stephen King, my goodness. Wow.
Stan Lee, the famous comic.
Oh, yeah.
Stanley Martin.
That's right.
Okay. Lemony Snicket.
Oh, who is Lemony Snicket?
Daniel Handler.
Oh, wow.
Maya. I forget her last name. Maya Angelou?
Angelou. Maya Angelou. The poet, the great poet.
The great poet. Marguerite Ann Johnson.
Oh, I like Maya Angelou better.
Okay. O. Henry.
Oh, what is it?
William Sidney Poitier.
Okay, wow. O. Henry's so much nicer.
Boz, B-O-Z. Charles Dickens.
Oh, yeah. Well,
Mary Westmacott.
Oh, Mary Westmacott. That's Agatha Christie.
Agatha Christie.
Yes.
Good for you. Silence Duguid.
She published some letter, some unusual stories with that name.
Silence Duguid.
I don't know.
Benjamin Franklin.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Paul French.
Oh, I don't know.
Isaac Asimov, science fiction writer.
Okay.
Anne Rice.
That's not...
Daughter of Howard Allen Francis O'Brien, the father who authored The Vampire Chronicles.
Oh, wow.
She didn't want to be linked with her dad. Okay. A.M. Barnard. Louisa May Alcott.
Oh, wow.
And for all of you who haven't gone and seen Little Women in the theaters right now, I encourage you to see it.
Oh, did you go see it?
My wife and I went. It was,
yeah?
Oh, so well done. I mean, if you love that book and you love everything about it.
It's like one of my first books.
Oh, Mike, they did a great job in the movie. It's you have to see it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a have to see it. Flora Fayfield, another pseudonym of Louisa May Alcott. C.S. Lewis. Clive Staple Lewis. George Eliot, Mary Ann Evans, Lewis Carroll, Charles Ludwig Dodgson Alice.
Good name. Good name change there, Lewis.
All right. Who wrote Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. Voltaire.
Oh, wow.
Francis Marie Arthuet. That was a long time ago.
That was a long time ago. And I like Voltaire better.
Okay. George Orwell.
Wow.
His real name was Eric Blair. Ayn Rand.
Oh, some
wrote
Russian
the,
name.
The Fountainhead and
Atlas
the Fountainhead. Shrugged.
Yeah.
Elisa Zenjina.
Yeah, she had
Rosenbaum.
Mm-hmm. Difficult
okay.
Russian name there.
E.L. James.
I don't know.
50 Shades of Grey?
Oh, yeah. Oh.
Erica
the name
Leonard.
That I do not mean. Yeah.
All right. So a lot of times the names don't kind of, you know, what you think of in terms of the...
Now, the question, okay, so you can register in the copyright office.
You can register under pseudonym.
And then you register your company.
And then you assign the copyright into a company that doesn't have a disclosure.
So
no one can find out who you are.
No one. But but your agent knows.
Your agent will know, but they're under sworn secrecy.
And are they?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they, like, for example, if and this is some one of my listeners, obviously intends to write, I don't know if it's an anti or pro Trump book. Mm-hmm. I really don't know. But whatever it is, it's supposed to be very you know, a very strong book, mm-hmm. but doesn't want to be known for it.
Right.
So if his agent knows, okay, his agent is sworn to secrecy.
Yes.
Absolute secrecy.
So you have authors and or artists that want to operate in different genres or, you know, different places. Yeah. They'll have to select different names so they don't get pigeonholed.
Yeah.
The same goes in music. How about the famous singer Pink?
Yeah, I don't know that.
Alicia Beth Moore. Would she be as famous if she was known as that other than Pink?
No.
You got to ask. You got to ask that question. How about Prince?
Oh, I don't remember his name. Yeah.
He's one of the greatest musicians that's ever
lived. Oh, he is, absolutely.
Rogers Nelson. Would he
Rogers Nelson. I don't think so. No one would be.
How about the famous guitarist from Guns N' Roses who is starting a new tour next year? Slash.
Oh, wow. What's
Saul Hudson.
Saul Hudson. Oh, my goodness.
Doesn't
quite have that.
How about the lead guitarist from U2? The Edge.
Oh,
super famous.
I think we know what music.
David Evans. Right? And then one of my favorites, Pigpen.
Pigpen.
Yes, a man named Ronald McKernan who founded the Grateful Dead in 1965.
Wow. Fantastic.
So there's a bunch of reasons that people use pseudonyms. Like I said before, early on it was because you didn't know you wanted to remain anonymous because, you know, for Voltaire, maybe the church was going to come round him up.
But they are absolutely, the publisher and the agent could not reveal.
The agent and the publisher, right, would not reveal the actual person.
Okay.
Yeah, they'd be under secrecy contracts.
Yeah, because, I mean, the only...
And they wouldn't want to because they're getting part of it.
They could ruin it.
Yeah, exactly. Found out
if it becomes
a bestseller. One day you're writing the romance novels, and now you're writing these, like, terrible war, you know...
Things.
Yeah, the opposite.
Yeah, so they are sworn to... There's a reason for it. Yeah, my listener said, well, you know, if it becomes really a bestseller... Will the publisher, you know, just say, "Well, I'm going to say who it is just to cause more publicity"? So
after you make your first $10 million, and the sales are slowing down, all right, let's do something.
Yeah, what the heck? By that point, you say, "I don't care.
I don't care anymore."
Well, you know, this is exactly the kind of information that writers, you know, all of you out there, you really need to prepare yourself in so many ways. You need, from the day you start writing, you need to be already preparing for that copyright. You don't have to wait until you finish something.
No.
You can copyright as you go along, because if it's something that you think, you know, is something really hot and might be stolen, mm-hmm. copyright it.
There's no downside to copywriting it before it's finished. A lot of authors take years to write their books. The great masters of art took 10 years sometimes to finish a masterpiece. Yeah. So at what time can you really say, is it done? Well, if you have a copyright as you're going along, here's another case. Let's say you're halfway through your book and you die, okay? And if you had copyrighted it, then maybe your heirs will take it, finish the book, and release it. Okay,
and that happens.
It happens. So you don't have to wait to the end to copyright it. Get a copyright on, you know, if you put the pen down and say it's making it probably a month or two, so I picked the pen back up.
And advise them, everybody again, keep good records. Keep good records of.
We always tell everybody, sign it, and date it, and put it somewhere where it's safe.
Exactly.
You know? One of the things in Little Women, of course, is that she doesn't adequately hide her greatest novel, which is what was going to make her great. And when she got in a spat with her sister burned it.
Yeah.
That, which is one of the plots of the story, important part of the plot of the story.
Okay. Well, everybody, thank you so much, Bill, for coming in today. This is an interesting subject and one I'm sure we'll come back to as more of my listeners, because this year is my year to really encourage all of those people who are dreaming of writing to write. Yeah. And so I want them to start off the right way and get everything in order and start thinking about the future. And so...
And our takeaway today is, before you say it, don't say it.
Don't say it. Okay, so Bill, again, how do people contact you?
LarsonPatentLaw.com. We're on the internet, so anybody that has questions is free to get a hold of me. There's a email box there. You can send me questions, or if you need help with legal advice, LarsonPatentLaw.com. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Bill Larson, he's our legal eagle, and that's great advice. Okay, thanks, Bill. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I have a very, very special and wonderful guest coming up now. But before I talk to her, I want to play a little song for Dinamos. Okay, are you there, Dina? Are you there, Dina?
1, 2, 3, 4. Wake up, wake up, wake up. Wake up, wake up, wake up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wake up, wake up, wake up.
Hey, Dina, you're there? Are you awake?
Yes, I am woken up.
Okay, well, I love that. I love that song. You know, I have it on my iTunes thing, frequently played song, and I play it every once in a while, and I say, wake up, everybody.
Thank you so much. That's amazing.
Well, I was so impressed when you came on the program. I was impressed with that. I was impressed with your wonderful book, The Buddha Sat Right Here. And I just enjoyed talking to you so much. And as I said, I put it on my playlist so that I can play it. And I've sung it a few times to my son when he's home from university. he says, Mom, yes, okay. I said, maybe you want me to record it in my voice. He said, that's okay. But I think the song is great. It shows part of what I said, when I got your email, you are the only person who sends me an email that gushes. I just, you have such a wonderful, positive attitude, and you're so interesting. I just love hearing from you.
Well, you know, everything I do with my writing and my book and talking about it, it really comes from my heart, and I have to feel the inspiration to put it out there. And so when I get inspired, I get really inspired. You know, it comes from within.
With your bubbly spirit. And, you know, not many people have had the chance to meet the Dalai Lama. Not many people have done what you and your family did. So I'm just going to let you explain to my listeners about about this book, about what this fabulous adventure, and so many people dream about doing something like this, and of course few people do it, but it's really quite an amazing story.
Thank you. Yes. So in 2014, I was right smack in the middle of raising my kids. I had a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old, and I was a working mother. I was working as a midwife, and I was trying to do it all, you know, and be a working mom, be a present mom, keep the house together, meet all the expectations that we have on women in general, you know, do it all while looking good and feeling good. And I was exhausted and had a lot of moments of doubt that this whole project was really sustainable for families in the 21st century. And I got this wild idea. It had always been my dream to go to India, and because I'm Jewish, but I was very interested in Buddhism. I've been studying Buddhism for 15 years, and my husband was a very dedicated student of Buddhism, and he had spent a year in India in his youth as a single guy traveling. And I just got this wild idea of what if we just packed it all up and took the kids traveling for a year and you know, unsigned up from the violin lessons, the ballet rehearsals, the school projects, the volunteering, the working, the paying the rent, and just have this adventure as a family. And my husband remarkably agreed to it. And so in early 2014, we set off on this almost year-long adventure. We rented out our house, and we went to India and Nepal and then Thailand at the end. And we traveled backpacker style. We just had packs on our backs. The kids had to carry their own stuff in their own little in their own backpacks. Actually, my 14-year-old could carry the most out of any of us. But and we went in search of opening our hearts and having new experiences and learning about Buddhism. And we had a remarkable adventure. We spent a lot of time in the places that are sacred, the sacred sites of Buddhism, such as the park where the tree is, where the Buddha literally sat under the tree and awakened to enlightenment. We spent a lot of time in Dharamsala, India, which is in the Himalayas, and that is where His Holiness the Dalai Lama lives, and the Tibetan government in exile is located, and it's a large Tibetan refugee community. And we went trekking in the Himalayas in Nepal, and just so many amazing things. And it was an incredible journey. And when I returned home, I just had to write about it. There was just no option. This story wanted to be shared because, just as you said, a lot of people, you know, dream of doing something like that and want to learn more about spiritual life and India and the Dalai Lama. And for so many reasons, they can't do that. It's just not possible at this time. And so I wanted to share our journey so that others could sort of take a little armchair trip and experience the things we experienced and learn from the things that we learned. And so that's why I wrote it. And well, then there's like another layer, which is like issues with my marriage that came up along the way, which originally I didn't think I would put in the book, but then I ended up putting the difficulties my husband and I had and sort of the reckoning our marriage had. I actually put that in the book because I realized that that's a really important story too, and that it's just so hard to raise kids and be married in modern American life these days, and why not be honest about that too and see how people can forgive each other and grow together and figure things out. So that ended up in the book too.
Well, most people just wouldn't have the nerves or the energy to do what you've done. I want to take a step. First, I want to say, of course, one of the great things about the book, and it's why this book is so special is that rather than, you know, writing about your daughters, you had them include their own stories. And so this also, we see a development over the period. So those stories are, just wonderful that you've done that. But I want to take a step back. I mean, where did you leave from? Where did you fly out of?
San Francisco. We live in Northern California in a little town called Chico, which really got put on the map last year when Paradise burned to the ground right up the hill from us. And this was before that. Yeah. And so we came from Northern California.
Okay. Well, I know Chico well. I used to live in Sausalito. So here you are. You get on a plane. And you headed, where did you go to? Did you go to Bombay? What city did you land in?
We went to New Delhi.
New Delhi.
We went right to New Delhi, yes. Well, and the other piece is that my sister actually lives in New Delhi. So she's a foreign correspondent for a major British newspaper. And she was living in New Delhi. So we had a place to land, which is why... That I think that gave me the courage to do this crazy thing is knowing there was sort of a home away from home.
You had a little bit of a base, but then you rented.
Yes.
You rented. What did you rent?
No, we just traveled a lot. I mean, we just stayed. We stayed with my sister for a few days to acclimate to India, get over jet lag, just be there and visit with her. But then we traveled all over the country, and we went by train and bus. Just like the locals do. India has one of the most developed railway systems in the world because when the British were colonizing India, they did create an incredible railway system, India Railways, which is still used today. It's the biggest mode of transportation in India for the 1.7 billion people there.
But that, most foreigners don't travel with regular people in India, do they? I mean,
there's a lot of. I mean, some people just go to India and sort of take up the luxury to take a private tour. I think is the most common way to travel, and there's not a lot of Americans travel that much in India. People are astonished to meet a whole family. Everywhere we went, people were so happy to see an American family with kids traveling because it's actually not very common.
I'm sure it's not because most people don't have the nerves to do it. I mean, it is difficult enough to take. I've seen people struggle taking kids to Europe, let alone to India. I mean, really, it's funny. My girlfriend went to Europe with her three boys. And they drove her crazy because they wouldn't eat any of the food in France. So,
oh my goodness.
And all they wanted was McDonald's. And they're like, she said, we could get crepes, we could get this. And so she was really a nervous wreck from that trip. But your kids they ate the food, they
yep.
interacted with just ordinary people.
And rode the trains and carried their packs. We prepped them. We talked about it for months before we left. And they grew up spending a lot of time camping with us, just simple tent camping. And as you heard from the beginning of our show, we have a little family band. We're used to going to music festivals and just eating kind of simple, sleeping kind of simple. So we really prepped them that there would be no McDonald's. I mean, for us, we don't really eat McDonald's, but macaroni and cheese. You know, there'd be no Annie's macaroni and cheese.
But, I mean, it must have been, there are a lot of people in India, more than in Chico.
Yes.
I mean, the quantity of people you see in India. You know, it's different from anything we have here in America.
Oh, yeah. It's like stepping out to another planet. It's so vibrant and chaotic and beautiful. And crazy. And, you know, our kids, I mean, so I loved it. My husband loved India. And what I think is that our feelings about it were contagious for the kids. Like, they picked up on our excitement, our joy. And even now, like, so many years later, and they are so much older. The 14-year-old is now a 20-year-old in college. And to hear them talk about their experience there, it just gives me goosebumps, because they see it so positively. And they were prepared that it would be hard, and they would see poverty they've never seen, and they would see suffering that they've never seen, because in America, the suffering is kind of kept away, and we really try to avoid exposing our kids to it. And in India, that's just not possible. Everything is happening. The beautiful and the horrible is all happening, like, right in front of your eyes. And it's a very powerful teaching about life on Earth. And my kids are still really inspired by it, and especially my older daughter. You know, she's really taken this path to a, she's going to go into a career in social justice, and she's really inspired to plug in and help the world. And I feel like the India trip really helped her that way, to be inspired.
Well, okay, so you got on the trains, you got on the buses. they're
yes,
crowded, and I don't know, I traveled a lot in Iran, and I did travel on buses where we had animals as passengers, and they were not support animals. They were, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not, yeah. It's just so wonderful to think of you doing that. And the food, how did they get into the food? You're traveling.
Yes, they adapted. Well, we found the things we loved. So, and we could find that, you know, so, I mean, the kids, they developed a taste for Indian food. I mean, that's what there is to eat there. But, you know, we found the dishes that the kids really liked, and, you know, we could get the naan bread and the rotis, the big wheels of doughy bread to dip into the spicy sauces. And, you know, they found their things. And in India, the sweets, and the sweet treats are incredible. And so, you know, we also supplemented with lots of ice cream and Indian sweets and these little Cheetos called masala munchies. So, yeah, they managed. And then, you know, every once in a while when we were in an area that really caters to tourists, you know, we could get pasta dinners and, you know, even macaroni and cheese once or twice. And so those were like, oh, my gosh, you know.
So in addition to traveling by bus and train, is it true that you also went on elephant?
Yes. We ended up taking an elephant ride in Bodh Gaya very spontaneously. There was an elephant who lived there. There was an elephant who lived in the Hindu. So Bodh Gaya is the place where the Buddha attained enlightenment, and it is the center of Buddhist pilgrimage for the entire world. But it's also a traditional Hindu village that has been there for, you know, more than 5,000 years. And on the edge of the town was a little Hindu ashram, and an elephant lived there for use in sacred ceremonies and parades, etc. And the elephant had a caretaker who took her for a walk every day along the river and through the town just to get her exercise. And a friend took us to meet the elephant. And then the next thing we knew, we were invited to ride on the elephant, which was, for me, a very terrifying experience. There wasn't really anything to hold on to, or saddle or harness. We were just kind of sitting on a blanket on this giant elephant. Yes. And the fact that I lived through that, I knew that that was sort of the beginning of the trip. And when we lived through that and I got off that elephant and walked away intact, I realized that the rest of the trip would be just fine.
Well, and where did you stay? What did you find hotels along the way? Did you find where did you sleep?
Yeah. Well, there's everywhere in India. There's little guest houses. They're kind of like Airbnbs in a way, but even more simple. Like people just rent out rooms in their homes to travelers, or they have these little low budget guest houses, and you know. So we stayed in these in guest houses pretty much everywhere we went that are kind of catering. I mean, there are people traveling, backpacking through India. They tend to be younger and single, or, you know, young couples. I mean, they call it there's been people traveling through India that way since the 60s, really, when the original hippies discovered traveling through India. And so, you know, there's still an infrastructure for that. We could find guest houses wherever we went, and they really only cost a few dollars a night a lot of times, and included a breakfast in the morning, and it was cooked by the family. It was a great way to travel.
Do they call them duck bungalows?
No, they just call them guest houses.
Just guest houses. Okay, well, you know, I think it's what you've done is fantastic, and well, the book reads that way too. I mean, as you said, you wrote the book to give people this experience, and it's just a great book. And I hope that, you know, you're having fun. You're going around touring and talking about the book a lot.
Yeah, and the book has won 6 major independent book awards.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about.
It just keeps winning awards. It won the Independent Publishers Book Award Gold Medal for Travel Book. It won the Next Gen Independent Book Award in Travel. It won Reader's Favorite Gold Medal for Travel. It won the International Book Award Book on Eastern Religion. What am I missing? I think that's... Yeah, that's 4 or 5. Anyway, they're all listed on my Amazon page. I can't even keep track of all of the awards it's won. So that's been a lot of fun, and getting to go and accept these awards. And I've been on a book tour, and I'm working on another book.
Okay. Well, do you have a website?
Yes. It's my name, which is Dina Moes, DENAMOES.com. And you can just Google the Buddha Sat Right Here and you'll find me.
Well, I think, you know, it was Beshert that you contacted me and that I could have you on. I really needed this, actually. I needed somebody. So, you know, sometimes I get books that are, you know, about different subjects. And so I needed this book, and I needed your cheerful and your delightful email. It just came at the right time on the right day. And it really was meant to be, because you put a smile on my face. I immediately, you know, the minute I heard your name, I you know, because as I said, you're on my playlist, and it's just a joy. It's a joy to meet somebody who is so adventurous, and I think it's just a testament to your nature, that you have this wonderful, good, warm, kind nature, and it comes through in your book, and I think you've done a wonderful job with it. I have a feeling at some point somebody is going to pick it up and make a film of it, because there's so many little, you know, adventure things happening in there, and there's this human interest part, you know, the emotional part with your marriage and that, but also any movie with kids running around in American kids running around India, eating Indian food, and as you said, I think it's a good experience for Indians to see an American family, and not, you know, hippies, and which so many of them resent, but to see a real American family, and to see one that is so joyful and wonderful as you are.
Thank you so much.
Well, you know,
I
think it'll be, we'll have another time that, you know, you said you could give me 50 minutes. I could only give you 25 minutes, but I'll have you back, okay? So next time you win an award, contact me and we'll have you back on so I can just have this opportunity to play your song. And I say goodbye to everybody, I'm going to play it on the way out of the program today too. Simply, I want people to wake up, and not just smell roses, smell India. I mean, what the heck? It's wonderful. It's
smell the curry and the incense and the butter lamb. The samosas sizzling
and
by
the flowers,
side of the road.
The flowers
and the cows, the cow dung in the middle of the road.
Exactly. Well, Dina Mose, you are absolutely terrific, and I'm so happy that you came on Joy on Paper today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really fun.
Okay, keep in contact. You're going
to
come back, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Dina. Okay, the book is available on Amazon and wherever books are sold, but just go to Amazon. She has a page there, and you can find out more about Dina and this wonderful, wonderful book. And it's a book that really, you know, it's the kind of book you read it and you say, "Whoo, wow, she's something special." And to read about the girls and that she let them write their own sections so that she's now just writing about them. She's letting them express themselves, and one of her daughters is dyslexic, and so it's wonderful to see the stories that both of the girls write. Wow, this has been a great day. Remember what Bill Larson said: think before you push that button, before you send out any messages, think twice about what you want to say on the internet. Because it is true that it stays there forever, as we have found and discovered, that even people, when they think they've deleted something, my goodness, it comes back to haunt them. So be very careful out there. And as a writer, there's nothing more important than your reputation. You do not want to ruin it by doing something silly and posting negative things about other people, because you never know how they are going to react. And the last thing you need is a lawsuit. But if you get one, contact Bill Larson or Larson & Larson, because he is a fantastic intellectual property lawyer. And he's my lawyer, and I highly recommend him. And you can just look for Larson Patent Law. He does my patents. I have 4 patents, by the way. And so he's just a fantastic, fantastic lawyer. But try not to get in trouble in the first place. But if you have a contract, especially if you get a big contract from New York City, make sure you see him. Because remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book. Or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps, my goodness, a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't know unless you start writing. And this is the beginning of 2020, and it is a time for you all to start writing a page a day. And by the end of the year, you're going to have a book. My goodness, it's so exciting to think about that. And keep in contact with me. Go to radio-joyonpaper.com. If you need help or suggestions on query letters or anything else, just send me a message. It's right there on my front page, and I will be happy to get back to you and give you some advice and maybe put you in contact with somebody who can help you, okay? And meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed, for everything. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Everybody, have an absolutely wonderful weekend, full of reading and full of writing. Bye-bye now.